Okay, good evening, everybody. Jeff Wensing, OEA Vice President. In conversations in the past, I addressed the successful passage of the CARES Act, where Ohio received well over $900 million for education for pre-K through 12, as well as higher ed. Well, now we need your help. We need your help to pass the HEROES Act. The U.S. House of Representatives has done its part. It swiftly passed the HEROES Act on May 15th. The bill includes $915 billion direct relief for state and local governments that can pay for vital workers such as educators. Let me say that again, $915 billion direct relief for state and local governments. Also, there will be $90 billion in additional education funding to support students and help save educator jobs. So what does this mean for Ohio? This means specifically Ohio will receive a little over $3 billion, $3.2 billion. Roughly $2.1 billion will go to pre-K through 12, and just under $1 billion will go to higher ed, and they'll set $200 million will be able to be set aside for additional money for the state to figure out what they're going to do with it. So OEA's position has consistently been that OEA members cannot return to work until our students can return safely to school. Ohio's educators want nothing more than to be in our schools and classroom with our students, but their health and safety remains our number one priority. Before we can safely welcome back our students, our schools and classrooms must have additional funding for PPE, digital learning, we might refer to it as distance learning, and we have to address the systemic underfunding of classrooms for students of color. These are just some of the things that we need before we can safely welcome back our students to the buildings. Those needs don't even begin to address the revenue shortfalls our schools will face as a result of the COVID-19 financial crisis. If Senator Portman can't match the investments passed in the HEROES Act, our schools will be shortchanged, leading to the loss of jobs from our schools and our classrooms. This means larger class sizes, less one-on-one attention, and fewer course offerings for programs like art, music, and athletics that help our students reach their fullest potential. The HEROES Act will provide the money for our K-12 students who need the most support. The bill also provides money for higher education students receiving Pell Grants at our public colleges and universities, so that no matter where a student comes from, the crisis doesn't prevent them from reaching their full potential. So this week, Senators Brown and Portman, mostly Senator Portman, Senator Brown has been a champion for us, rock star. Senator Brown and Portman must hear your voice and the voices of every educator so that they understand what our students need to go to school safely. So you can visit the site, nea.org/COVID-action, and tell Senators Brown and Portman that students and educators and communities need them to support the HEROES Act. So that concludes my report. I hope Scott's ready to go.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it. I was on an OEA phone line, and apparently the weather knocked out our phones, so I'm back on my cell phone. So sorry for the temporary silence there, but I know that we still have a lot of people on. So at this point, I want to turn to our poll question and we'll give people another opportunity to weigh in. What is your greatest concern when thinking about the 2020-2021 school year? Is it your safety and that of your family? If so, press 1. Is it concern about the feasibility of social distancing in schools? If that's the case, please press 2. If your number one concern is about losing your job or having your pay cut due to budget cuts related to this pandemic and the economic downturn, press 3. Or if your biggest worry is about meeting the needs of your students, especially those with limited family resources. Press 4. And we'll let you vote here for a second and report those results in just a few minutes. We've got hundreds of people that are expressing their preference, so I want to give people a chance to do that. While you're doing that, I am going to give an opportunity to our state superintendent, Paolo Di Maria, to say a few words, and then we're going to open it up to your questions and comments. State Superintendent Di Maria has been a great partner. OEA has been working in collaboration with school boards and superintendents, principals organizations, with other labor organizations, with representatives from the governor's office and Department of Education and Department of Health to make sure that we address our top priorities. Number one, making sure that whenever school reopens, that we are first and foremost protecting the health and safety of our students, of the adults who work in schools, and our community. That we are supporting local flexibility within clear guidelines, that we are encouraging collaboration and collective bargaining, that we are focusing on equity, meaning that we are meeting the needs of those students who run the risk of being left behind. This pandemic has exposed and exacerbated deep inequalities, and the technology gap just starts to scratch the surface on that. We've been working together to advocate for time for assessment and planning and preparation for next year and advocating for resources. That's where OEA is coming from. Those are going to continue to be our priorities. But I want to turn it over to Paolo Di Maria. And before I do that, I'll share with you that right now those four concerns are almost equally divided. I think the number one concern, 33% say you're concerned most about the feasibility of social distancing in schools. Second, 27% concerned about meeting the needs of students, particularly those with limited resources from their families. Third, but close behind, 22% of you say that you're most concerned about your own health and safety. And third, 17% of you, and that's way too many, are concerned about your own job security. So with that, we'll go ahead and stop the poll. And Paolo, welcome.
Scott, thank you so much. I'm just so very pleased and humbled to be with all of you this evening. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedules to be part of this. And I'm going to start, you know, by very simply but profoundly and deeply saying thank you, thank you, thank you. I don't think anybody ever imagined that in the last 3 months what we've gone through was going to be part of the story of the 2019-2020 school year. And yet, when it happened, the education community, the teachers, classified staff, administrators, everyone really stepped up and gave their all. And I was continually amazed and so very, very proud of everything that I saw. The dedication, the commitment, the caring for children, the solutions orientation that people brought, the can-do attitude, the willingness to be flexible, to be agile, to make the sacrifices and work in collaboration, forge new partnerships, explore new ideas for continuing to provide educational services. So much posted to social media, so many moments of pride and care and dedication. It just filled my heart with joy and admiration and appreciation. So thank you for everything that each and every one of you did over these last 3 months and all the time, because frankly, that sort of amazing story is really the characteristic of what teachers and educators are all about in the first place. Giving their all, making a commitment to students, showing that love and care and concern, being creative, doing the things that need to be done in order to support our students in achieving success. I think there is some general agreement that the curve has been flattened. And that's a good news part of this story. But the bad news is the coronavirus is still with us. And I love the sort of results of the poll because I think it shows the same kind of different perspectives and opinions that we're hearing from everybody across the state about how best to proceed down the path of restarting the various sectors of the economy and restarting the education system. And I got to tell you that we get lots of communications from people who kind of put their stake in the ground around one or the other of those different perspectives. I hear a lot of folks who say, look, It's so important that we return to school as normal. Let's not talk about distancing or masks or you know, other things like that. Let's just, you know, it just needs to go back to the way it was. And I hear people on the opposite extreme that say, you know, I'm not going to be ready to either send my children to school or to be back in the classroom unless I know that I can be assured that this, you know, coronavirus has passed us and that my safety and health can be assured. And then everything in between. So, I mean, the way Scott set up the question is, what can we anticipate? And I think we're going to have to bring to bear the same kind of skills and abilities that we did over the last 3 months. We're going to have to be collaborative. We're going to have to be flexible. We're going to have to be agile. We're going to have to, you know, be looking for those opportunities and solutions to address the realities that we're all going to face. And we need to create, you know, networks and communication channels among ourselves, because I think this also emerged over the last 3 months, where people were talking with each other more than ever before, sharing ideas, sharing, you know, their experience with these new challenges and developing solutions to meet the needs of students in their communities. Scott was absolutely, I love the way he articulated the four priorities of the OEA, because they match exactly the kinds of priorities that we bring to the table as well. Clearly, protecting health and safety, that's been a cornerstone of the governor's approach to dealing with this pandemic. He continues to work closely with the Department of Health, and he, you know, admittedly takes a very cautious approach, because he knows and has seen across the state the tremendous havoc that this disease can cause to individuals, to families, to communities, and he has to be very sensitive to that. At the same time, he also recognizes, as do I, that there's a place for flexibility. We've embodied that idea of no one-size-fits-all in the state strategic plan. We do it in lots of our other policies. And I think here, too, will be an opportunity for us to say, look, we can't design a one-size-fits-all solution for this particular situation. We have to trust the professionalism. We have to trust the educational expertise of communities, of teachers, of administrators to come together and figure out what's best. At the same time, we have to trust the scientists and the health experts as they think about and make recommendations about the health and safety precautions that have to overlay the reopening of school. The other point about collaboration and collective bargaining, again, we have embraced those concepts. They're reflected in some of the draft guidance that we've already been working on, because we know that we're always stronger when we work together. There are too many examples of failed experiences when somebody at the top says, this is how it's going to be, and if there's no buy-in, no investment, no real embracing of that approach, we all know that the implementation is never going to be what it could be, and people will just go through the motions. And so we have to sit around the table. And even though these are going to be very challenging decisions and challenging situations to address, we are always stronger and better at creating those designs when we work together and we implement together. So that is something that we will continue to push. We've been pushing it with all the different associations meet from time to time, and there's consensus that we have to be collaborative and we have to be respectful of the collective bargaining process as part of that. And finally, the equity question. I think, you know, at this particular time, not only coming off the pandemic, but also coming off the horrendous death of George Floyd and other incidents like that, those situations and the protests that they've generated clearly send the message that we have got to do more to address what happens in our schools, because what happens in our schools can be solutions and make a contribution to those situations, and our efforts have to continue to be applied aggressively to addressing the needs of every student so that they can be on the road to success and be partners with those who are advocating for change. So what you will ultimately, you know, see unfold here fairly quickly, because, you know, the opening of school is largely right around the corner. You'll see some information eventually come out from the Department of Health that will specify the health and safety parameters. That'll be followed by some information from the Department of Education that will be more of a guide for planning, effective planning for districts. We will not prescribe the education experience that every district will provide to students. That will be up to them. And then today, the General Assembly was doing some legislative work that resulted in some and setting the policy context, because we understand that because things are likely to be different, we also need to have different policies in place that accommodate those realities. And we will continue as the department to provide additional information and resources, responses to questions, and helping people to situate themselves as best they can to provide a great educational experience as we start the new school year. So with that, Scott, I'll wrap it up and turn it back over to you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I do want to mention one thing. And first off, if there's anybody on the speaker line who's not speaking, if you can just make sure that you mute your phone, that would help. But, you know, speaking of the legislation that was passed today, originally it was Senate Bill 319, and 319 ended up getting folded into House Bill 164. Always fun watching the legislative process play out. But we had raised a particular concern that we thought was problematic in relation to collective bargaining, and that was in the original legislation, there was language that would have authorized school boards to circumvent collective bargaining agreement and impose furloughs, temporary furloughs on staff. I think a lot of people felt that some of that may have been well-intentioned, that a furlough would be a positive alternative to a RIF, a permanent reduction in force. But we raised concerns, and we were very happy that the legislation passed unanimously out of the Senate without the controversial furlough provision included in it. And that was largely because of your advocacy, the fact that our members spoke up and legislators listened. So that is critical when we talk about collaboration and having a voice at the table. So I want to open it up the first person I'm going to call on is Alicia from Dayton. I think you have a question that's probably on a lot of people's minds. Go ahead, Alicia.
Yes, Scott, right?
Yes.
Reiterating, we want our children to be safe, and we want to educate them, but we also want to feel that everyone is safe, children and adults, because our children are going to come to school, hypothetically, if that were the main choice for the particular school system, and then not only be around other children and the adults, but then they're going to go home and be around another set of adults. So it's just, you know, it could be a snowball effect. It could affect more than just the children and the adults that are educating the students. You go back home and you're around another set of adults, and it's just a snowball effect. So how can the safety of everyone be ensured versus distance learning, which would seem to be a safer bet?
Yeah, thank you for the question, and I will. I'll just briefly comment on that, and then ask Paolo if you want to add any more. We know that when we're talking about safety, it's not just kids, and we know that for the most part, children have shown that there's you know far less vulnerability in terms of serious illness related to contracting COVID. But we also believe and understand, based on the science, that they can be carriers of the virus, and I think that was a big reason why schools were closed in the first place. We're concerned about the adults who work in our schools, and we're also concerned about the family members that those children, you know, interact with, their parents and their grandparents and their aunts and their uncles. And so, you know, school is a place where community spread can happen, and that's why we're depending on public health authorities to lay out very clear guidance when it comes to, if necessary, social distancing and masks and sanitation and health checks and a variety of other things. So, Paolo, is there anything else you want to add about protecting safety and health?
No, I think you've covered it, but I will say that I think the caller's observation is right on, because, you know, what's going to happen is these 1.7 million little people, our students, you know, for the last 3 months have been, you know, in some ways isolated, or at least their encounters have been limited to a relatively small number of adults. And now all of a sudden we're going to increase the number of encounters they have, both with other adults and with other children. And that's the kind of recipe that the epidemiologists sort of keep their eyes open for as a risk, right? And then the Department of Health, they take a lot of heat for their prescriptions. But the reality is they're all about reducing risk. The more protections you can put into place, and I know sometimes that takes sacrifices. I know there are inconveniences about every single one of the tools in their toolboxes. But with each one you implement, that has a benefit from a health perspective. And I know sometimes people will say, but wait a minute, forget about the health perspective. What about the social-emotional perspective or the educational perspective? And all of these things have to be balanced. And when I watch the governor, you know, talking about the different sectors in Rio, you can tell that he struggles with trying to find that balance. And I think we all have to engage in our communities and with our districts and with our teams about talking about those balances so that at the end of the day, we can feel as comfortable as possible about the health and safety of the adults and the students, while at the same time recognizing that we also have to tend to social-emotional issues as well as educational ones. And what's important is that we keep communicating with each other. We keep talking with each other. We keep sharing ideas, and that we also stay flexible. We've got to say, hey, if there's a bus driver that has a medical condition and just really is highly susceptible to the disease, then we have to find another way to allow that bus driver to function, or the same with the teacher, or the same with a student that has to remain at home because they could in fact be affected by the disease. And yet, how do we respect that? Okay, we still owe that student an education, or we still can use that teacher for a particular function or a particular job. That kind of flexibility, which is often accompanied with creative thinking, is going to be paramount.
Hey, thank you. Our next question, gets at another element, another perspective on this. Julie Ray from Northridge Teachers Association.
Teachers.
Please go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for this forum because it's great to feel connected to, since we've not been feeling connected for a few months. But I'm a special educator, and so my students with exceptional needs just require hands-on, require kind of a personal involvement. And I just, I'm not afraid, but I just feel like they're not getting what they need, and they're kind of being kind of like looked over. So I'm really concerned how we can make sure that they're thought of when we do set up some kind of a plan to return to school, because it won't work. Even though I work with high school kids, it won't work as far as online. It just doesn't.
No, thank you, Julie. And when we talk about the equity issues, I know that that's been one of the biggest concerns. We've gotten some flexibility from the federal government in terms of, recognition that there are things that schools just aren't able to do in terms of providing support. But that's one of the things that I think educators are most concerned about are students, including students with IEPs who were just struggling to meet their needs. And so when we talk about equity and we're thinking about doing things differently, I believe, and we've talked about this from the association's perspective, we have to prioritize those students who have the greatest needs when we're figuring this whole plan out. But Paolo, can you talk a little bit more about, how the department is looking at students with exceptional needs in its planning?
Absolutely. And thank you to the caller for raising this question, because during the school building closure period, there was, no more significant issue than how best to address the needs of students with disabilities. And to be honest, I think we all know that no one was prepared for what happened. We had to sort of pivot on a dime. In terms of that pivoting, we knew that it was human-to-human encounter that was actually what propagated the disease. And so we had to sort of sacrifice those elements to a certain extent in order to be more aggressive in terms of combating the disease. So you're absolutely right. Nobody liked the situation that we found ourselves in because we had to say, hey, look, we have developed an IEP for this child that included these kinds of services, and now we're in a position where we can't really provide those services, so we have to either do our best using, other options, or just put things on pause. And we know fundamentally that's not normal for us, and that's not fair. But in some ways, a sacrifice was made in the interest of addressing the pandemic that we face. So we have to be particularly attentive to that reality as we transition. But we also have to remember, as the previous caller pointed out, but some of these students also are the ones that are likely to be the most susceptible to any kind of disease, right? And so we have to be cautious about that. And there again, it becomes one of those things where what level of risk are we willing to take, and how do we at least attempt to minimize that risk while still being duly attentive and responsible for providing the services that those students, you know, absolutely deserve and need to be successful. So again, it comes in conversations with parents, with educators, making sure that people are using the, you know, I know we're likely to see lots of new and emerging either research or resource guides that, you know, provide us with opportunities to learn new approaches or new ideas for how to provide those services, given the conditions that we face, and we will continue to apply ourselves to make that successful. We hope to issue some additional guidance from the department's perspective, as we did during the school building closure, on different aspects of the educational delivery, and there certainly will be information about addressing the needs of students with disabilities.
Yeah, thank you, Paulo. And just a reminder to everybody that if you have a question, press 0 on your phone. I know I've got a lot of people in the queue for with questions. We're going to get to a few more, but know that anybody that has a question that's not answered, you'll have an opportunity at the end of the call to leave a voicemail message, and we review every single one of your questions, and we make sure that we answer them as best we can. So let me turn now to Justin Klein from Kettering. You have a question. Go ahead, Justin.
Yes. So I teach at Kettering, Ohio, in Kettering, Ohio, and I have taught here for a number of years, and my wife has just started. I know that our district has taken steps to ensure that we are not laying off teachers, but my concern is what's going to happen in the following years with teachers who are newly hired.
That's a good question. It's actually gets at the critical need to make sure that we have resources and that despite the economic downturn that's causing some real revenue crunches for the state and for local school districts, that we get federal funding relief that Vice President Wensing was talking about, you know, earlier in the call. So I think so many of the issues and challenges that we face, including how we meet our students with special needs, how we make sure that we've got the technology that we need, how we make sure that in a time of pandemic, the class sizes aren't actually getting bigger because we don't have the resources to pay teachers and education support professionals. It really does, in many ways, come down to funding. So, Paulo, I don't know if there was anything you wanted to say on that one.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say, tell your wife I say thank you, thank you, thank you for choosing to become a teacher, if I understand what you said correctly. Because, you know, prior to this whole thing, you know, Scott and I would periodically talk about, you know, teacher shortages and what were we expecting in terms of, you know, not having sufficient number of teachers. So I celebrate every young person or old person or ex-military or anybody that chooses to enter the teaching profession because there's such a great need. And it's also, you know, to me, the greatest public service job that there is. You know, that said, I think Scott's point is well made, that the economic situation is a challenge. But in the past, our experience shows us that through a combination of various, you know, tools and strategies, whether it's federal assistance or you know, state funding strategies, we've been able to preserve, to a fairly great extent, our ability to provide the staffing support needed. And we also know at some point this will all turn around and things will go back to normal. So I think we all work with the hope that districts and schools will find the ability to make sure. And, you know, and again, this also speaks sort of the social distancing, because people are saying, well, if I'm going to have smaller classes, I actually need more people, not less. And how do we reconcile that with the financial situation? But, you know, the bottom line is there's a bright future in teaching. And I'm also relatively optimistic about even the short term, because we're going to need all that help in the interest of reopening and providing the educational services we desire for our students.
Thank you. I want to now turn to Lori Sparrow from Yellow Springs. Go ahead, Lori.
Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is well. I have a question. It's been a remarkable last few months, not only with the pandemic, but with what we are seeing and learning and coming to grips with as a society around racial inequity. What are we planning from the Department of Education standpoint to help seize upon this national moment to address the idea that our students of color have inequity in access to education, in resources, in funding? And, you know, when we talk about equity and I talk about the corona crisis, I also think about, do these students have access to math? I mean, something so basic, you know? All of inequity seems to be tied in this. So my question is how are we going to begin and continue this movement to start to bring real social equity?
Thank you very much for the question. Paula, do you want to go first on that?
Sure. I mean, I think there are a number of things. First of all, if you go back and look at the strategic plan, there's a really powerful through line of equity throughout. And so increasingly, you have seen a number of initiatives, everything from we brought a group together, and I think the OEA participated mightily in this work about increasing the diversity of teachers and those who enter the teaching profession, because that's an important component of the issue that you raise. There are equity activities happening in special projects in career technical education and making sure that disadvantaged students and underserved students have access to the best teachers. We've been conducting equity labs across the state as part of our work under the Every Student Succeeds Act. I think one of the messages coming out of the latest tensions is, what is the obligation of the education system also to apply itself to dismantling some of the systemic racism that exists in our society, and what does that look like? And I think, you know, we all understand that journey takes a number of aspects. The first one is really a very personal journey, a self-understanding that I think each of us has to go through to understand, you know, the history of racism in this country, how it is, unfolded, the oppression that it's caused, and the reality that children in the African American community, have to deal with the pressures and oppression that come with that on a day-to-day basis, and that has to have an impact on their educational experience. So it starts, and one of the things I've been most encouraged by is seeing groups of teachers getting together and improving their own learning and understanding of issues of systemic racism and beginning to strategize, which is what we're doing in the department as well, strategizing about what more can we do that specifically addresses those issues. Are there things relative to our social studies standards and other parts of our curriculum that we need to address? Are there issues related to helping us all better understand our own implicit biases? And once we recognize those, how can we make sure we're overcoming them? How do we make sure that we aren't, projecting lower expectations and that we're, in fact, helping to make sure students have the access they need and the additional supports that they need in order to master the content? Are there pedagogical and other approaches? I'm an advocate myself of mastery and competency-based learning models, just because I think they ensure that students are mastering the content at every step of the way rather than simply, mastering enough content to pass the class or what have you. So it starts with that self-discovery, but then it also has to be collaborative, because I think what we've learned is if all of a sudden somebody unveils some sort of thing that says, now the education community is going to do this, if people weren't involved in the design of the work and involved in the understanding the impact and the potential that our actions can have to dismantling racism, that's what it takes and what it's going to take in order for us to make progress on the issue. So, I would be remiss if I didn't also talk about trauma-informed practices as well as cultural relevancy and making sure that the work that we do isn't simply focused on one group or another, because it's as important for our white students to understand the history of racism and understand their role to play in the cause of social justice.
Well, thank you. And I will just say that, well before George Floyd's killing, the OEA Board of Directors had been already engaging on defining what social and racial justice as a priority of the organization is going to look like. what does that look like in terms of our advocacy for all students, particularly students of color? What does it look like when we're talking about the relationships that we build and leaders that we develop and the kind of professional support that we provide to members that Paula was just alluding to? We are committed to racial and social justice, and we know that you can't talk about this COVID pandemic without acknowledging that it has had a disproportionate impact on people of color in our society and has exposed great inequities, and OEA is committed to addressing that. So we have a lot of questions. One of the questions that's come up in many, many different ways is the question about funding and people concerned about what are we doing. So I'm going to put another poll question before you. You already heard from our Vice President, Jeff Wensing, who talked about the importance of talking with our senators, encouraging them to pass legislation. We're seeking $175 billion in dedicated relief for public education. We know that the state is facing a tremendous budget gap, and Congress is uniquely situated. So, Christy, if we could post this, the next poll question, and it's a fairly simple one, and that is, will you commit to taking action to ensure that we in Ohio's public schools have the resources we need to protect education jobs, open schools safely, and meet the educational needs of our students? And when I say taking action, I mean talking to Senator Portman and Senator Brown and other members of our congressional delegation. If you say yes, press 1. If you say maybe, press 2. If you say no, press 3. We'll give you a moment to vote. While you are voting on that poll question, I want to thank Paulo for being with us. You're welcome to stay on the line if we have time for more questions towards the end. We'll try to take a couple more. But at this point, while you're voting, I want to turn it over to Nick Gerch. Nick is the Director of Education Policy Research and Member Advocacy for OEA. And his department is really instrumental in providing our members with a lot of valuable resources. Nick, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate what the caller said earlier when asking a question and talked about feeling separated and alone. I think a lot of us feel like that right now, and that's been a real big challenge of this whole time. But we as union members and we as staff and members of OEA are not going through this alone. There are a lot of resources that are available to members of OEA to help support you as you get through this. And so we have a couple folks from our department on who are going to talk about that. I want to take a couple seconds here just to talk about a few things that we've been working on since the shutdown happened. The first thing is that if you go to OHEA.org, OEA's website, there is at the very top of the page a COVID FAQ, a frequently asked questions. And so that is where we are hosting a lot of answers to the frequently asked questions that we have been getting around this. So if you have something that you're unsure about, that's the first place that you should check. We also internally within OEA have what we're calling a return to school work group. And the goal of that work group is to create a document specially tailored for OEA members that complements what ODE is putting out. There are some things in the ODE document that are going to be challenging, and we need to make sure that we are asking the right questions of the leaders of our districts, and that document is going to equip you to do that. And so that will be coming out through OEA staff to local leaders sometime soon after ODE releases their document. So those are a couple things that we've been working on. I want to pass it over to Demetrius Davis to talk about an opportunity with our Summer Academy.
Thank you, Nicholas. The virtual 2020 OEA Summer Leadership Academy is scheduled for June 22nd through June 23rd, June 24th. The conference theme is People, Power, Possibilities. The goal of the virtual conference experience is to help OEA members at all levels of the association realize and develop skills and talents as leaders of their profession and their association while building relationships and organizing for power. The virtual 2020 OEA Summer Leadership Academy will start at 2 p.m. on June 22nd, followed by a welcome and a keynote address that will be delivered by Christian Moore. He's the nationally recognized author of Resilience Breakthrough, 27 Tools for Turning Adversity into Action. The conference breakout sessions will start at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, June 23rd, and the topics will include reaching the wounded students, teaching and learning from a distance, four strategies to build resilience in every student. In addition, we have a variety of breakout sessions within the following conference strands: leadership development, organizing, professional issues, student success and supports, government relations and communications, and we have a leadership development skills for new OEA local presidents. Becky Pringle is our closing keynote speaker. She's the Vice President of the National Education Association, and her closing address will uplift the collective power of the association. The conference will conclude at 1:30 p.m. on June 24th. The conference will conclude at 1:30 p.m. on June 24th. We hope you will join us in the reimagined virtual 2020 OEA Summer Leadership Academy to celebrate our people, power, possibilities. To register, visit OEA's website at oata.org. I hope to see you there.
Thank you so much. Demetrius has done a really incredible job of switching this conference very quickly from in-person conference to a virtual conference, and we're really excited about being able to offer this. We often get feedback from people that it's not practical for them to take 3 days and come down to Columbus and come to a conference. And so this gives everyone a really great opportunity to do this as we're doing so many things right now from our own home. So thank you very much, Demetrius. If you go to OHEA.org and scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll see a square at the bottom there that says Summer Academy. If you click on that, it'll give you all the details you need about schedule and all those things. And if you can only make it for part, please feel free to jump in and off on and off as you're able throughout the course of a few days of that conference. And now I want to have also from our department, Ellen Adornetto, talk a little bit about some professional development opportunities that we offer through OEA.
Thank you, Nick. So I'm going to remind everyone about the great resource that we have, and you can find this at our website. The educator communities, or ed communities, continues to be a wonderful source, especially during the pandemic where we are all isolated. This is an opportunity to reach out to a variety of educators across the state and across the nation. And maybe a good thing about the pandemic is that we're all in this boat together. So other people who are grappling with what next year might look like, needing resources, dealing with student trauma, et cetera, they're great minds coming together on that website. So don't forget about that resource. Again, that can be found at the OEA website, Ed Communities. The other resource opportunity I want to highlight is the micro-credentials, which are also available on the Ohio website. If you search micro-credentials, it'll take you right to the connection page. These are a benefit of membership. These are free to all educators. This is PD that is 24/7, meaning during summertime when it's very important also for you to take care of yourselves through all of this, you can set your own pace for this professional development. We're hearing across the state of people having to learn and grow on what might next year look like as far as teaching goes, and I'd like to highlight a couple of the micro-credentials that link into those needs. When you get into the micro-credentials, you'll notice there's cyberbullying, cyber safety underneath bullying free. We have network and internet under computer science. It also addresses technology facility if you're learning and you're in that process of learning how to facilitate technology. There's also a section on evaluating digital sources. We need to continue to be good consumers, both personally and professionally. And there are also continued topics such as virtual engagement, strategies for asynchronous and synchronous learners. So there's plenty of topics that are available through the micro-credentials, PD for educators, that are poised to meet the needs of, as we ask that question, what will school look like next year? A reminder, you do need to follow your local LPP procedures regarding any pre-approval. You have up to 6 months to complete any micro-credential, and it is 24/7, meaning you can do it at your own pace. And subject to your LPD's approval, you can be granted CEUs, and that can go towards your relicensure. Did I mention it was free? I just wanted to say that one more time. And hope everyone is safe and well. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thanks, Ellen. And again, if you go to OHEA.org, we've moved the link for the micro-credentials right to the front page there. It's actually right under the Summer Academy link. So if you scroll down to the bottom of the page, you can find it there. There has been significant investment on the part of members of OEA and NEA affiliates across the country to develop these micro-credentials, and they are available to you free of charge as a benefit of being a member of OEA. So I encourage you to please use them. That wraps up our comments. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you very much, Nick, and hope that you will all take advantage of those resources. The poll question was, are you willing to take action to ensure that we in Ohio's public schools have the resources we need to protect education jobs, open schools safely, and meet the educational needs of our students? 65% of you said resoundingly yes. Another 32% said maybe, and only 3% said no. 97% is pretty good. And so if you want to take action, there's two things that you can do. One, go to our website, OHEA.org, and you'll see a link for taking action right there on the homepage to contact Congress and ask them to pass essential funding relief. We make it really easy for you to do that by email. And then also we need people to make phone calls. And you may get a phone call from us or from our friends at NEA tomorrow asking you to go ahead and complete the call by calling in to Senator Portman in particular. When you get that call, I hope you answer it, and I hope that you'll take action that way because that's really critical. As I look at the questions that we still have in the queue, so many of those questions are about funding. I do want to call on one person, though, that has a question about testing. And I just had it in front of me. Maureen from Mount Gilead. Go ahead, Maureen.
My question is about any pause in the state testing so that we can focus on bringing our students back up to speed on curriculum, dealing with the psychosocial and emotional issues that we need to deal with, and also on any savings that might be available by not having to do the testing.
That is an excellent question, and I will tell you that we've made some good progress on that issue. House Bill 164 that I mentioned earlier didn't go as far as we'd like to go in terms of putting a pause on testing altogether, but we are advocating for that. That is at the top of our priority list as an organization as the legislature continues to figure out how to navigate this situation. We think testing, even before coronavirus, was out of control. And so we're working to try to reduce it. And just as state testing was suspended this year, we think it would make sense to suspend it next year as well. The legislation that passed today, though, did provide some relief on the third grade reading guarantee moving forward. It also included a provision that will remove student growth measures from teacher evaluation for next year. So those are a couple of important provisions. And then the House recently passed another piece of legislation that we've been advocating for some time, House Bill 239, that would move us closer to federal minimum requirements for state testing, as well as holding local school districts accountable for doing standardized testing that goes above and beyond what's necessary, and engaging parents and educators in those conversations to determine what is it that is most essential for helping us support our students. So really, really appreciate your comment on that. I see a number of questions also about PPE, personal protective equipment, and you know, what are we doing to advocate on that issue? We have said very, very strongly in our conversations with state officials that there need to be clear guidance in terms of what PPE is required, and also for any school employees who are required to wear PPE, that they need to be provided with that PPE by their employers. The draft guidance that the latest draft guidance that I've seen from ODE includes that provision in it. We're going to continue to fight for that. Of course, there is continuing discussion about the issue of masks. You know, we know it's a hot button topic. We understand a lot of people have said that they're worried, you know, is it feasible for students to be able to wear masks in schools? I think there needs to be some flexibility. But if public health authorities say that masks are required, then we need to follow that guidance. And if they say that they're not required, then I think that's pretty important. We're not going to substitute our own personal judgment for the expertise of people who do that for a living. So we have quite a few questions. If you did not get a chance to ask your question live, we are still going to track your questions. If you are not in the question queue, it's not too late. All you need to do is press zero. And at the end of the call, we will have a voicemail line where you can leave your question, and we will get back to you as soon as we can with an answer. And we will also share a recording of this telephone town hall for tonight on our website. So if you have colleagues who are not able to join us this evening, they will be able to listen to the conversation. We really do appreciate you taking your time to be with us, and hope you have a great evening. Thank you so much for your participation on the call. Thank you for your commitment to students. Thank you for being a member of our union. Have a great evening.